Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Bone Picker, Native Stories, Alternate Histories, by Devin A. Mahisua, narrated by Charlie Flight. Introduction. The late Cherokee writer Robert Conley wrote in 1988, "The American Indian spirit world does not exist as a world apart from the real world. The world we inhabit in this life is both physical and spiritual. Indeed, as we go about our daily lives, we think about those entities that we cannot see, those beings who do not speak back to us. Most of us also wonder if our behavior is appropriate in the eyes of the powerful spirits who created us." A large pantheon of deities exist in Choctaw lore. Those entities created the first people, taught them how to hunt, warned them of impending danger, and introduced them to food. The stories about these beings are not told just for entertainment. Each entity and their behavior had a purpose and a lesson to impart to those who will take heed. Also in the pantheon of supernatural beings are frightening creatures that help explain human nature. Elements of horror in a tribally centered story are not unusual. We think about frightening creatures in our cosmological tales. Owls hooting can be a harbinger of something bad, including death. Strange shapes beneath the water's surface might be Okanahulo waiting to pull someone under. If you stay out after dark, Hashak Okwa Huiga or Kashehotapalo might lead you astray. If you think bad thoughts, Nalusa Chido will know it, and you will pay a price. Worthy Choctaws, however, might encounter Koe Anukasha, the little people. The actions of all the beings mentioned in this collection take place outdoors. The natural world is, after all, intimidating for people who spend most of their lives inside. Darkness plays a role in many traditional stories, and with good reason. You cannot see the beings you fear coming, but you can sense their energy. If you do catch a glimpse of them, it is only partial. In my long career, I have researched, written, and taught about racism, stereotypes, genocide, treaty abrogation, health disparities, poverty, environmental destruction, ethnic fraud, missing and murdered Indigenous women and boys, desecration of Native burials, boarding schools, racism in the academy, pretendians, and fake news. These are real-life horror topics, difficult problems to solve, stressful to deal with, and oftentimes life-changing. Composing fictional stories about real-life histories allows me to create the endings that I want to see, and the act of facing scary cosmological creatures with a keyboard also gives me some control over what I fear. The Cornfield. According to the old stories, Choctaws and Chickasaws were once the same people. Eons ago, they emerged from the underground world to the surface at Naniwaya in Mississippi. Two brothers, Chattas and Chicksaw, led two groups in different directions. Those who followed Chattas became known as Chattas or Choctaws, and the others were Chicksaws or Chickasaws. Non-human entities followed the Chattas on their forced removal in the 1830s from the southeast to Indian territory. The Koe Anukasha, the little people, Champes, and Kashehotapalo, the deer man, trailed over land, out of sight. Other non-humans, such as Hashak Okwa Huiga, grass water drop, and Nalusachito, the huge black one, knew the underground well and kept pace with the humans from the dark, subterranean passages. The shape-shifting opas, the great horned owls, followed the haggard emigrants from above. Most of the entities liked to tease and annoy the Chattas, but of all the entities, only the evil opas, the great horned owls with yellow eyes, took pleasure in tormenting and killing them. West of present-day Eagletown, Oklahoma, 1835. Ellis Crow made a horizontal slice under the squirrel's tail, then made two cuts over the rodent's hips. He laid the small animal on the ground, belly up, his right foot on its tail. He took hold of the back legs, then yanked upwards. Most of the hide ripped free of the carcass in one motion. Then he tugged on the skin of both legs and threw the smaller pieces of pelt into the trees. The furry bits hung on the branches like Christmas ornaments. He cut off the head, pushed it to the side because he favored the brains, then severed the 4 feet and scraped them off the table and into the dirt. Varmints would eat those. Then he slit the animal up the middle and pulled out its guts. Those also sailed into the forest. 5 more cuts, and he had severed the limbs and cut the torso in half. He tossed the meat into the kettle of hot water sitting over the small fire. Ellis started to crack open the skull when he heard the rhythmic squeaks of wagon wheels. He smiled. It had been a few weeks since anyone came down his road, and Ellis missed interacting with his inferiors. He watched as 2 horses pulling a wagon came around the curve 25 yards from his house. The driver pulled up his team and scanned the intersection. The man could steer his horses right and go east, but that road was deep-rutted and grown over with vines and small oaks. He might continue south past Ellis's house, or he could turn left onto a well-maintained road with fields of tall corn stalks on both sides. As Ellis predicted, the driver kept his horses still and asked for his advice.
Alito,
the average-sized Choctaw man in all brown clothes offered in greeting. His wife sitting next to him wore a dingy calico dress and broad-brimmed hat. The day was hot, and both were dirty with the dust that stuck to their sweaty skin. Ellis figured the tired couple to be survivors of the removal. The horses looked old. The bay seemed exhausted, and the black one foundered. Not for much longer, Ellis thought.
Alito, Ellis answered. Chim achukma.
The couple eyed Ellis, and clearly they did not like what they saw. Ellis did not care. He did not like them either.
Achukma hoke,
the man answered. He did not bother to reciprocate the question and ask how Ellis was doing. Still, Ellis acknowledged the man's response.
Achukma,
Ellis said.
Osi tamaha chito ut katima,
the man asked. Ellis grinned and pointed to the road that cut through the cornfield.
Yokoke,
the man replied, then turned his team. Ellis was not lying. The town known as Osi Tamaha, Eagle Town, really was to the west. Ellis watched the wagon as it bobbled down the road that he had taken great pains to make flat and clear of foliage. As the trailing dust obscured the disappearing wagon, Ellis stirred the squirrel in the pot. He opened the skull and dropped the extracted brains into the small iron skillet and watched it cook. Satisfied that supper was on the way, he imagined spooning the chunks of boiled meat and fried brains into his dirty bowl, then sat back in his rocker and waited for the screams. 1902. 208-year-old Ellis Crow sat in his rocker and eyed the cornfield that flourished on his allotted land. The allotment was far off any main thoroughfare, and by design, the roads leading to him were not in good shape. Few people traveled his way unless they had permission to hunt on allotted land or needed to bury someone in one of the few cemeteries in the vicinity. Ellis preyed on the lost travelers. Of course, this was not really his land. He had killed the man whose name adorned the allotment papers. Garden Folsom. Garden, Ellis thought, Who names their brat Garden? No matter. Garden had no family, so there were no heirs to protest. The land now belonged to Ellis under that odd name. He sighed and tipped back the whiskey bottle. It had been a big day. He did not feel tired, but he did feel gratified. 3 Chata turkey hunters had knocked at his door after supper. One of the 3 men had a broken leg, and the other 2 carried him. They were bone-tired, just the way Ellis liked his new acquaintances to be. They had asked if he knew of another home in the area. Ellis was happy to oblige.
"My goodness," Ellis had said after seeing the compound fracture of the tibia. "He hurt himself." "No horses."
"Kyo,"
the dark one answered, shaking his head.
"Good," thought Ellis.
The injured man moaned and grabbed his leg. The other 2 restrained him.
"Needs to be set," Ellis said. "I don't know how to do that, but there is an Alikchi who can, and he can ease his pain."
"Katima?"
asked the short one with the dark skin and unmistakable look of a traditionalist. The man's dark eyes narrowed. Ellis felt a jolt of alarm at being scrutinized, but he forced a smile. He hoped that the injured hunter preoccupied any thoughts that this clever man might have about witches. Still, Ellis had to be careful not to betray his nature. Ellis pointed to the well-traveled road. Rather, it appeared to be well-traveled. Every morning, Ellis strapped a wide leather belt around his waist. The belt had 10-foot lengths of barbed wire and small diameter oak branches attached to it. He trudged 100 feet down the dirt road, dragging the wire and posts to maintain the road's appearance. Then he hid his makeshift drag harrow in the bushes. As he walked back to the intersection, he pulled weeds and other wayward plants to give the impression of an oft-used lane. The next morning, he pulled the drag harrow back toward the house and hid it behind the shed. Every unsuspecting traveler was eager to get to where Ellis directed, and no one noticed the lack of horse tracks and wagon wheel ruts. After the oblivious trekkers made it down 50 feet of easy road, the lane curved and then straightened for another 30 feet, then made a sharp right turn and steeped downhill. It became narrower, hemmed in by dense rows of corn. At the bottom of the hill was a deep creek that ran across the road. One could not see the condition of that road on the opposite side of the creek because it banked sharply to the right. Good thing, because Ellis did not maintain it. One could stand at the edge of the stream and ascertain that the only way to cross was over the shallow rocky area that lay 40 feet to the right. The rows of corn were conveniently spaced far enough apart so that a wagon could easily traverse through the stalks. This was where the fun began. Ellis held up a finger and then hurried into his cabin. He brought back strips of cloth. One of the hunters held his injured friend's foot while Ellis quickly wrapped his legs together. The best splint for a broken leg was the uninjured limb, but Ellis had another motive. Binding the man's legs together meant the 2 hunters would have to use both arms to carry him. Ellis pulled a pint bottle from his pocket and offered it to the man. The traditionalist gave him a look that could wilt pokeweed, but the suffering man grabbed it. He put the bottle to his lips and drained the bottle.
"Yakoke,"
the injured man whispered. Ellis nodded. He watched as the 2 healthy hunters lifted their colleague under his armpits and under his legs as they struggled with their load down the road. Ellis smiled so big that he unconsciously began to shift. His owl beak poked through his gums. He allowed the transference to commence. 1988. Ellis Crow used the pink pail to water the hollyhocks in the flower beds in front of his house. Last year, He had added 2 half whiskey barrels filled with small moss roses on either side of the 4-step walkway leading to the porch that was bordered by clematis-covered horizontal rails. He had recently re-roofed the cabin with shaker shingles, removed the detritus that littered his front yard, and kept the small lawn manicured. This was, of course, in direct contrast to his backyard and the interior of the house. Ellis discovered a few decades prior that wandering people were more apt to stop if his home looked as if a woman lived there. He wore jeans, a clean white t-shirt, and Converse sneakers. He ran his hand through his heavy metal hair. Ellis had seen Guns N' Roses play Welcome to the Jungle on MTV and decided he liked Axl Rose's looks. The new do was a change from his waist-length straight ponytail that required nothing more than a finger combing and a leather tie. Ellis still looked to be only 25 years old, and this style seemed to appeal to young people. Older ones appreciated that he looked busy with the push mower he kept in his front yard. Hot, dry wind ruffled his hair. Crows flew up and out of the cornfield, caw-cawing, then settled back inside the tall rows. If Ellis had planned on harvesting the corn, he would need to do it in the next few weeks. He had no interest in eating or selling corn, so he left the dry stalks up until they began to deteriorate, usually after New Year's Day. Then he burned the fields and pushed piles of dirt onto the road leading west and parked an old bus in front of that so the road was essentially invisible. He slept during winter, woke in March, and replanted the corn the 3rd week of April. His corn only needed to be knee-high for his season to begin. Just as the sun started to set, and he thought he would go another day without a visitor, a brown and green Ford Escort station wagon came down the road. He could hear the engine knocking. Maybe about to throw a rod, he thought. The vehicle sputtered to a stop in front of Ellis's house. A harried man got out, and his equally upset wife exited the passenger side. Both Choctaws looked to be well-fed, and Ellis suspected neither would be able to walk far.
I told you this would happen, the woman yelled at her spouse.
Her voice sounded hoarse, which meant she had been verbally assailing him for some time.
Shut up, Marilyn, he responded. How was I supposed to know the car would give out? I said it would.
She slammed the door so hard Ellis thought it might fall off.
You're a piece of shit, Jeffer, and so is this car.
Station wagon, Jeffer corrected.
Ellis walked toward the incensed couple.
There's a gas station not a mile from here, that way.
He pointed to the smooth dirt road. There were, of course, no service stations in that direction. Ellis continued.
If you got water in the gas tank, well, that might be causing those knocks. You can fill it with good gas down the road a bit.
The man drummed his fingers on top of the car.
A mile, you say? Yes, sir.
The man looked at the woman.
Marilyn, get in and we'll get to the station. You got kids in there?
Ellis asked, wondering if children might be asleep in the back seat. Although with Mom yelling, he doubted it.
No,
the woman shrieked. Ellis felt disappointed that there were no children, but he did like her rage. Marilyn huffed, then got back in and slammed the door again. Her partner did the same, although not as forcefully. Jeffer started the engine, which knocked. Then he put the station wagon in gear and slowly turned onto the road. Ellis remained motionless until his eyes rounded, his beak poked through his gums, and his arms and legs began to shorten. Feathers pushed through his skin and replaced the hair on his head. He shrank, stepped out of his shoes, and shook himself free of the clothes. He stretched out his wings that spread over 6 feet from tip to tip.
The feathered tufts on his head were unusually large and looked like thick deer spikes. Ellis Crowe, the witch, followed the station wagon as it slowly made its way toward the creek. He circled while the couple got out, and Marilyn began yelling again. Her voice rose in intensity, then Jeffer screamed back at her. Ellis glided and waited as Jeffer considered the impassable water, then looked down the bank. He pointed toward the crossing point, and the woman quieted. They got back in the station wagon, then started through the rows of corn. Ellis flew closer and watched the station wagon move another 100 yards, then suddenly take a header straight down through the camouflaged witch hole and plummet into the underground. 2023. Ellis observed from the shade of his porch as two mountain bikers approached. He had only seen riders one other time. Maybe these two had started from I-70, or perhaps the Eagletown High School. The 20-something men looked fit. Ellis scrutinized their colorful bike wear. The helmets were streamlined and attracted the eye with their colorful swirls. The tops were crazy abstracts of colors, and even their tight bike shorts were neon green and yellow blaze, the latter an odd choice for a male, but Ellis didn't dwell on it. 2 years prior, Ellis had created a facade advertising a small convenience store next to his home. He never intended for anyone to enter the empty structure. He just wanted people to stop. And these two did.
"Hey man, you got any Gatorade in there?" the thin black man asked.
"And Tylenol?"
his white companion added.
"No, but I had an orange juice. Unfortunately, the freezer gave out and it's no good. But there's a Quick Trip less than a mile down that road. It's got everything. You got a headache?"
The muscular white man straddling the expensive green Yeti mountain bike answered.
"My back and knee."
He pointed to his right leg that had recently hit the dirt and now suffered a bad case of road rash.
"Sorry, guys, no pain stuff, but that Quick Trip will have it."
The black man looked at his phone.
He muttered. "The GPS is stuck back on the highway." "Yeah, we're in a low spot," Ellis said,
hoping they wouldn't notice that they were not in a low spot.
"This way?"
the white guy asked.
"Yeah, just a little ways."
"Okay,"
he answered. "Thanks, man."
Ellis watched the man's powerful thighs push down on the pedals. Maybe he should get a mountain bike. "I'll take his," he thought. The bikers could easily turn around by the stream and come back, so Ellis transformed quickly and flew to where he knew the duo would be discussing what to do. The pair balanced on their bikes and looked at the water blocking the road. Ellis dived and hit the black man's helmet with his heavy wings, not hard enough to make him fall, but forcefully enough to scare him.
"What the hell?"
he yelped. "Is that an owl?" he yelled as if he were looking at a pterosaur. Next, Ellis batted the white man on his shoulders.
"Jesus,"
he screamed. Another swat on the white man's back and his partner yelled, "Through here." The black man pushed down on the right pedal, shifted gears, and sped through the open space in the corn. His friend followed. Ellis hovered and waited. Within seconds, both men screamed as they fell into the witch hole. Ellis followed them into the darkness like a dive bomber. The murder of crows that had been feeding on the corn around the entrance rose with the hot air. They cawed as they watched the events from a safe distance. All was quiet, except for the dry wind rustling the equally dry corn stalks. Then the breeze stopped, and the crows settled back into the corn. A few minutes later, Ellis burst from the hole, his talons gripping the handlebars of the green Yeti mountain bike. A week later, Ellis walked through the rows of corn, kicking dirt clods. He faced a dilemma. He needed to attract more people to his place, but he had to stay off the main grid. This was a problem he had wrestled with for 190 years. He could reach out to his crow brethren, but then he'd have to share. Ellis knew if he did that, his operation would be in the hands of the more powerful witches. So far, he had been able to keep his hobby hidden from them. He had not seen any of them since 1820 back in Mississippi, and they probably thought he was dead. He had no need of company. He had no need of females. Isolation did not bother Ellis. All he wanted to do was get rid of everyone. Ellis was reaching into his pocket for squirrel jerky when he heard a rustling in the corn. He lifted his chin and sniffed, but he did not have a good sense of smell. Maybe it was a deer. The thought of killing the deer and eating its organs excited him. He pulled out the long bowie knife from the sheath strapped to his left thigh and waited. The rustling began again, and then stopped. Curious to see why the animal halted, Ellis slowly stepped to his left toward the sound. He sniffed the air again and caught an overpowering scent strong enough even for him. After a few seconds, he abruptly stepped back. He did not smell a deer. Nalusophilia, the long black one, began to show himself. Ellis had only seen the creature one other time back in Mississippi, and that was in the twilight. An elongated black head, not unlike a black racer snake with ears, rose up until it was above the stalks. Then the creature stepped forward on short, muscular legs. At its full height, the 7-foot-tall Nalusophilia resembled a hairless black weasel.
"Ellis," it whispered.
"That's me," Ellis answered. He stood his ground, although he felt fear for the first time in 2 centuries.
"You have gone too far."
Ellis realized he had no spit in his mouth. All he could do was straighten his back.
"What do you mean?"
But Ellis knew exactly what the beast meant.
"Too many years of hurting people."
Ellis furrowed his brow. He didn't think it had been too many people. He thought he had not tortured enough people. Nalusophilia did not wait for a response.
"I let them go."
Ellis huffed in astonishment. The hundreds of people he had sent into the cornfield, into the underground world. He took one step toward the beast. That was as far as he would go. He didn't know what Nalusophilia might do to him.
"You released them?"
Ellis asked. Provided they had survived the 30-foot fall, that is. And if they did survive. Ellis knew that the underground world spanned the continent from east to west, with tunnels extending from the North Pole to Patagonia. The world was not hollow like the tinfoil hat-wearing hollow earth theorists argued, but there was plenty of room underground. Some areas were the dominion of entities he did not care to face, such as the grasshopper goddess who oversaw the lives of the crawfish people. And there were deep holes with no discernible bottoms. He believed that the survivors fell into those pits. Ellis had been curious as to the domains of other tribes' entities, but he had been cautioned by the elders of his family to never trespass into their territories. He had heard that after death, Hopi spirits traveled the salt trail and back into the earth. And had all the Navajo monsters been slain? What if some were still underground? There were too many tribes across the Americas that he had no knowledge about.
"I have always released the Chattas," the enormous black entity hissed. "Not the others. They would tell. Chattas know the importance of keeping us together."
Ellis felt dumbfounded. Did Nalusophilia push them up from the nearest witch hole 30 miles away in Doakesville? Maybe.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?